Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors. Welcome to the PI World webinar on Thursday, 16th of April, 2020. I'm your host, Tamsin Freeman. Today we're joined by Jamie Streeter, also known as @CompoundIncome on Twitter, who will outline his investment strategy and how he's navigating the COVID-19 markets. Jamie's going to give a presentation and it's titled Investing, Compounding and Surviving the Corona Crash. And then there'll be time for questions at the end. Jamie, thanks so much for joining us today. Over to you.
Okay, thank you, Tamsin, and thank you to everyone on the call for taking time out of your busy schedules to listen in today. I hope you'll find it useful. Just to start off, you've probably never heard of me, so I thought I'd start with a quick introduction in terms of who I am and what my evolution as an investor has been over 35 years of investing. I'll then go on to look at sort of why I compound income and my philosophy that goes with that and portfolio construction that comes out of that for me and how that works for me. Next, after that, I'll show you about how I find investments that sort of fit in with that philosophy and process and help go towards that portfolio construction. And then finally, give my emphasis on income. I'll look at the outlook for dividends and the market post the corona crash and how hopefully I'm surviving that. I'm conscious that I've got a lot of slides to get through, so I'm not sort of going to go through this line by line, but you know, the detail is there. In essence, you know, I spent 24 years as an investment professional across various firms, managing lots of different funds. And then for the last 11 years, I've been investing independently, having left full-time employment back in 2009. So, I mean, that's the headline summary. As I say, I'm conscious we've got a lot of detail to get through. So let's get cracking. My evolution as an investor within that sort of 35-year career, if you like, I suppose I started out as a value stroke growth at a reasonable price investor. And so back then used to look at things like PE and yield relatives, and you know, always looking for those that were cheaper than market but growing faster than the market, and therefore you could look forward to re-rating. Let's say that subsequently became known as growth at a reasonable price along the way. I've always been attracted to income investing, and I've come to appreciate sort of quality along the way in terms of sort of balance sheets and trying to buy decent companies. It's a bit sort of motherhood and apple pie, I suppose. But really, it's important to think about protecting the downside as well. So I've always been wary of leverage or gearing, not getting into too heavily indebted companies. After all, in this game, a lot of the battle or half of the battle is sort of avoiding losers as well as just picking winners. So and sometimes people might lose sight of that. I've also learned to embrace momentum factors along the way, especially estimate revisions. Although as a value investor at heart, I've always struggled with price momentum, as it seems to sort of conflict with looking for good companies that might be beaten up after underperforming. It also goes against the whole idea of buying low and selling high. But given the behavioral biases at play, it does seem to work. So as I've come to accept that. And the main place that's really helped me, I suppose, is avoiding value traps. Because if you're a value investor, it's often easy to say, oh, well, this looks great, I'll have some of that. But you know, actually, there's other stuff going on. And you know, if you ignore those estimate revisions and the price momentum, you can get badly sort of caught out. So I think you know, that's a big lesson I've learned along the way, and that's something that's really helped me. Also, as things have developed, obviously, when I started out, we used to do handwritten notes and calculate all the ratios ourselves. Since then, technology's developed and I've embraced quantitative techniques, and I still use those to this day, as you'll see later on. And also, I think the private investors are so much better served these days with the internet, access to information and lots of great services out there. So, yeah, good time to be investing. And obviously, lots of changes over 35 years. And basically, you never stop learning in this business. So let's look at those 35 years and see if there's any lessons we can learn. I hope you can see this chart on the top there, but basically that's showing the S&P total return index over pretty much that sort of time frame. It goes back to just pre the 1987 crash, which you can just see as the first sort of sell-off there on the left-hand side. And then there's lots of other events over that 35 years, as I make reference to there. Yeah, there was a savings and loan crisis not long after the 87 crash, various other things along the way, LTCM crisis, which I'm not sure is actually on this slide, and the Russian debt crisis in the late 90s. That was something that, comes along and you have all these worries and crises, as they're sort of suggested at the time. But when you look back at the chart here, you can see that they hardly show up. And I suppose, I'm saying that, whilst this is a pretty unique situation we're in at the moment, we've been through things like this in the past, so it's not that unusual. I mentioned there on the slide about the Greenspan put being minted in 1987. So obviously they came and slashed rates when the market crashed, and that seemed to do the trick back then. They didn't do it so much in the early 90s thereafter. There was a bit of a recession in the early 90s. But it's really in the late 90s that, I felt this sort of got going and has sort of snowballed since then, because it seemed as though, there was going to be a big sort of reset. And sort of think, well, it should be kind of an Austrian sort of economic theory. I'll let things sort of go down, let debt sort of be written off, weak companies go by the wayside, and then the whole thing resets. But they were very keen to sort of not let that happen in the late 90s, and they pumped in sort of liquidity and cut rates when this LTCM, which was a hedge fund at the time, that got into trouble by, and they were messing around in the bond markets and it went against them, but they got bailed out. So, or they bailed out the markets to help them anyway. And then ever since then, every time there's been a downturn, so in the post-dot-com crisis, and then, of course, even more so in 2008, 2009, although they did sort of experiment with letting Lehman's go bust, and then they sort of realized, well, that probably wasn't the thing to do because it might collapse the whole financial system. They really sort of came in big time. And then this time around, I think they've learned from that. And, almost as soon as this crisis hit the market, it's gone from being at a peak to falling within a couple of weeks. They've come out all guns blazing and literally thrown everything at the market. So increasing amounts and sort of more moral hazard each time. So there we go. I think we're going to have a poll at this point just to see how people are feeling about all that, because obviously the market has recovered quite nicely given all that money that's been thrown at it. So I think there was a survey last week when Stephen English was on, but just thought we'd do a quick update to see how people feel about that. And I think Tamsin's just put the questions up on the screen there. Did you want to go through that, Tamsin?
Yes. So based on history that we've just gone through, today, are you bullish that we've already hit the low, neutral that we'll retest the low, bearish we'll see a new low, or confused or don't know? And if you could answer that now. I'm sure you've run through this a million times in your mind, so you'll be quite quick at responding to this. Okay, should we give the results of these votes? So we've got 44% are neutral and we might retest the low, and 36% are bearish, with 15% confused and just 5% who are bullish that we've already hit the low.
All right, well, let's crack on to the next part of the presentation. That takes me on to why do I compound income? If you look at the chart on the right, that's something that attracted me to making income part of my process very early on. I remember the equity gilt studies that BZW used to do back in the day then, but it's now become the sort of Credit Suisse guide. And we'll have a look at that in a minute. Now, I know some people say, but it's not really about the dividends. It's all about capital gains. But in reality, it's a bit of both, because you have the dividend and you have retained earnings within the company. And then those are sort of compounding up together once you reinvest the dividend. And it certainly pays to reinvest and compound the income if you can. And on the left-hand side there, it's just an indication that it also pays to start early if you can. And that's just showing that if you'd started investing £5,000 annually and achieved a fairly modest 5% growth rate on that per year, how much you could end up with at the end of time, and how much less you'd have if you started 10 years later. For me, I started out when PEPs were around in the early 90s. I was able to put about 6,000 in each year at that time. And also back then, you used to get dividend tax credits, which could be reclaimed. So it made sense to me to target higher yielding stocks in a PEP, and then what became ISAs thereafter. Which is what I've done over the years, put more than sort of 5,000 a year in constantly as the allowances increased. And Quartz, I've made a bit more than 5% a year as well. So there we go. So this is just to say that obviously since 2009, it's been even more important to think about compounding your income. Because if you look at the chart on the left, back in the 2000s, this is showing interest rates and what you could have earned on sort of savings deposits versus the inflation rate. And also back in the 90s as well, it was possible to get a real yield off of cash deposits. Hey, remember that? Yeah, that was great. But since 2009, we've had this sort of financial repression going on. So governments have brought interest rates down to sort of record lows and bond yields have kept on tumbling and been brought down and held down by quantitative easing and other things like that. So against that background, if you're trying to sort of live off of investments, it's become even more necessary to take a risk with your money, and people have been forced into stock market-based investments. Indeed, back in 2009, it was possible to pick up sort of 4 to 6% net yields quite easily. But of course, you have to be prepared to bear the capital risk. And you know, I think we've had a pretty good 11-year period post that of sort of a, not quite a constant bull market, but a pretty good run. And obviously just now people are rediscovering the downside of the volatility that can come with equity investing. So the chart on the right is just a simplistic sort of inflation thing. If you have 2% a year inflation, that quickly eats away at your money. So you know, I think obviously compounding your income is a good way to try and tackle that. So let's have a look at the long-term picture on the next slide and see how that pans out. And this is coming from that Credit Suisse Global Investment Returns yearbook that I sort of referenced at the beginning. Here in the longer term, it's interesting to note over sort of 120 years and 50 years, equities offered the greatest returns. But both bonds and cash actually over that period have been okay. So as I say, remember, this is real returns. So this is after the effects of inflation that we were looking at on the previous slide. And it reflects that the UK has also been quite an international market along the way and done quite well over that longer term period. But so if you're looking at on the bottom section in 1900s to 2019 and 70s to 2019, actually the UK did better than global equities. Everyone always says, oh, well, UK's rubbish and you need to invest overseas. Well, that's not necessarily always been the case, but certainly in the last 20 years, yeah, global equities have done better than the UK. I think there's an element of which, you know, that it's where technology has come into play much more in that period. Obviously, the US and elsewhere are much bigger in that, and UK's got a bit stuck in sort of old industries like oil and banks and other things. So that's worth noting. Also, the other thing, bonds have nearly kept up with equities over 50 years, which would probably be quite unusual, but that's really reflecting the sort of 40-year or so bull market we've had in bonds as yields have just kept on coming down and down and down. And particularly in, you know, the last 20 years, that means bonds have actually outperformed equities again, which is somewhat different to the long-term history. But with bond yields being so low now, I'd certainly probably expect equities to outperform from here. Certainly given all the Fed support along the way, money printing and possible inflation ahead. Unless, of course, we end up in a deflationary depression despite all those efforts of the central banks, in which case bonds and cash would probably be a better place to be. But obviously time will tell on all of that. So what's my investment philosophy against that background and where we find ourselves today? What I'm looking to do is grow my capital and income in real terms over time. And as we just saw on the previous slide, and where we are today and where we were in 2009, I sort of feel that equities are the place to do that. Although I should say, as you could see from my career at the outset, I've been an equity man, or I am an equity man, so I'm probably biased in that respect. And equally, I've probably only invested in a fairly favorable period of time. So who knows what the future holds, but you know, looking at history, you know, I think that is still the place to be. I say, unless, of course, we end up in some sort of deflationary depression, in which case we're probably all doomed. But how do I go about that? Well, I look primarily in the UK because I'm a UK investor. My liabilities are all in the UK. So I know people go on about home bias, but you know, I don't really have a problem with that. And also, as we saw, international sort of makeup of the UK market means it's not necessarily as domestically focused as you might think. So I tend to ignore zero payers, blue sky, future hope type stocks or lottery tickets, if you like, and exclude those from the universe of stocks that I'm looking at. Also generally avoid EMP and mining stocks, as you know, I don't really feel I have an edge or a strong feel for those. Then the other important point at the bottom there is I use closed-end funds for diversification of asset classes and income sources. So that'll be where I'm getting you know, international exposure from there over and above that that comes from the stocks themselves, and also broadening out my income sources in addition to the UK equities I'm buying, again, getting income from other asset classes or around the world. So let's see how that feeds into my portfolio construction on the next slide. I use sort of a core and satellite or silo approach, if you like. So I have ISA portfolios, which in common with the Scores portfolio that I run on the website, is run with 20 to 30 stocks. So I'm looking there for slightly more active investing and monitoring, and looking to grow that sort of pretty well and compounding that up. Outside of that, I've got other longer term accounts, as I described, and where I'm looking to for a growing income generation, if you like. I use closed end funds in there too. That's pretty important. That's something I'll sort of come back to in a minute when we talk about dividends. VCTs are also providing me with a tax-free income, which I built those up when I was working, and they're now sort of doing that job for me. Again, in 2009, those did see their dividends coming down a bit, so I guess we could see that again this time around, although they've got some disposals and things they can probably pay out from in the short term, but there have been some regulatory changes recently, so again, they might sort of edge their dividends down a bit there. Then finally, just as prudential financial planning, would normally recommend 3 to 6 months cash in reserve to cover your expenses. I like to go beyond that and have at least a year's worth in reserve to cover, you know, fluctuations in investment income and emergencies, etc. But overall, you know, it's a very diversified portfolio. Now, people say you should be very focused and have you know, very focused portfolio, which I do to a certain extent in my ISAs, where I've got that sort of 25, 30 stock portfolios, which I think works pretty well for that type of investing. But when I was setting out to, you know, earn my living, if you like, from investing, I wanted to go for not max, but as much diversification as I could in terms of the assets and the holdings that I've got. Because the UK markets, as you know, you could buy a tracker, but that suffers from the concentration of income from the top stocks, like the oil companies and the pharmaceuticals and the banks. And we've all seen the problems with that over the years. So I've got about 98 holdings across all of that piece that we've just looked at there, which I know some people probably, whoa, what the hell? But that's split 50-50 between direct holdings and closed-end funds. And that includes the venture capital portfolio as well. By value, that would probably be about 60%, 40%. So 60 direct, 40% in closed-end funds. Basically, it avoids too large exposure to any one position, and also too much of my income coming from any one position. I guess the current corona crisis is a real-time test of that theory. So we'll see how that goes. Obviously, the closed-end funds, investment trusts, I do really like those, as we're finding out today or in these current times. Yeah, there's lots of unexpected dividend cuts out there. And I should probably say that these dividend cuts we're seeing are pretty exceptional. I have a bit more to say about the outlook for dividends in a moment. But you know, what I like about investment trusts is that they have the ability to maintain or build up reserves, which they can then dip into to maintain their dividends. And they can also pay from capital reserves as well. So, you know, I think that gives me quite a lot of reassurance that my income probably shouldn't be too badly hit through all of this. But nevertheless, I'm probably still looking at some reductions, but I'll sort of touch on that as we go through the next few slides or a bit later on. Next slide is, how do I find suitable candidates for looking at and further research? As I mentioned already, I do this sort of compound income scoring system, which I'll give you a sort of worked example of that in a moment. I do share that via my website, which people can sign up for a very modest fee if they're interested. But yeah, I think most people like to do their own thing and do things their own way. But you know, it's out there, and information is on the website if people are interested. Although I'd probably just caution that, you know, obviously at the moment, no company can really forecast. So you need to take all numbers with a bit of care at the minute. So obviously there are plenty of other well-known investment solutions out there, software solutions, which I'm sure most people listening to this are probably familiar with, plus publicly available information. I'm sure most of that's not any different to what most people do or use. So let's go on now just to look at the compound income scores and how they work. What I thought I'd do here is just take a couple of well-known large stocks, and we're looking here at some sort of conventional valuation metrics like PE, yield, price to book, price to sales, you know, classic value measures. And you can see here Vodafone versus Unilever on those traditional measures. Vodafone comes out pretty much on top on all of those factors. And I thought, just for a bit of fun, we'd just do a very quick poll here just to see, okay, looking at those metrics, thinking about the stocks, which one would you choose? So I think there we go. The box is up there on the screen for you. As I say, obviously Vodafone, mobile phone provider. Everyone's using their phones at the moment to keep in touch with people, probably calling people a lot more. So, and obviously the networks are still working, so they're probably still running okay, doing all right out of all this. Unilever, equally, people still got to eat, get their cleaning stuff. So again, you could think both of those would be not too badly affected by the current corona crisis. I mean, don't overthink, you know, which one. Just think which one, okay, on where we are today and based on those value metrics, what do you think would be good? I'm not trying to catch anybody out. It's not a trick question. It's just, you know, a bit of fun, really. And then I'll go on to show you how I look at these stocks with the compound income scores.
Great. Well, I think okay, we've got
Tamsin,
the...
I don't know how we're
yeah,
doing there.
I think we've got the answers now. 63% go for Unilever and 37% go for Vodafone.
All right. So if we go on from those value metrics to looking at how things are looked at in the compound income scores, I should mention here that the higher the score, the better in this case. So on the value score within the compound income scores, they actually come out about even here, whereas you saw on the previous slide that Vodafone was coming out better on traditional measures. So that's because I use also an enterprise-based valuation, so that's taking debt into account. And Vodafone, as you'll see on the way through, has a lot of debt, so that drags down their value score on that basis. Yield, it's better because that's the other thing I look at is yield in that sort of value score. So they're coming out about even on that basis. Cover, there's not a lot to choose between the two, although Vodafone would have worse earnings cover. I also take free cash flow cover into account, and Vodafone is a bit better on that measure, so it actually comes out slightly better on cover on that basis. Where it does fall down, though, is if you get into dividend growth. Here I'm looking at the sort of history of dividend growth and the forecast dividend growth, as you're probably aware, Vodafone's cut its dividend along the way recently. Unilever's been a fairly steady payer, so Unilever ends up in the top quartile on that basis, and Vodafone is in the bottom quartile. Financial security, this is coming back to the leverage point I made at the outset. So here, this is looking at the balance sheet debt, interest cover, that type of thing, and how that's moving. So again, it's a top quartile, bottom quartile split. And the same thing with operational quality, where I'm looking at you know, how good a business is it? So, you know, the classic sort of compounding thing you want to be doing is looking for a business that's got good operating margins, good returns on capital, so it can generate decent profits, earnings and cash flow. And that's going to help to underpin your dividend and pay that dividend to you in the future. So again, Unilever's winning out on that score. Estimate revisions, I say that's the sort of momentum factor I'm looking at here. Not a lot to choose between these two. They're both slightly worse than the average within the universe of stocks that I'm looking at. But, you know, it's useful to keep an eye on that because it can just highlight if, you know, the trends are improving or deteriorating. So overall, that gets put into, you know, rescored and re-ranked, if you like. And again, within that dividend paying universe of UK stocks, Vodafone's coming out nearly in the bottom decile, but certainly bottom quartile. Unilever is towards the top quartile. Now, it's not necessarily a recommendation to rush out and buy Unilever, but obviously you're a shrewd bunch because more people came out in favour of Unilever. But, you know, if you pick Vodafone, don't worry about it. You know, it's a market of stocks, and, you know, for every buyer there has to be a seller and vice versa. I have held both of them myself along the way, but I did sell out of Vodafone a few years back when it was around 200p, as I became concerned about the dividend prospects and thought there'd probably be a dividend cut coming through. Unilever, I've held for 4 or 5 years, and that, over that time it's gone from about £30 to £40. I mean, obviously, we don't know what the future holds. Some people are concerned that it might not last, but let's just have a look at those metrics on the next slide that have gone into those scores that we just looked at. I mentioned the enterprise value based EBIT to enterprise value yield. So that's effectively like sort of equating. So you can compare everything across the piece, and it would be akin to what you can get from a bank account, if you like, or an interest rate. Dividend growth, yeah, Unilever's better. Interest cover, again, that's the balance sheet coming through. And pretty 0.9 is pretty low, to be honest. I'd probably look for more like 3x there. But obviously Vodafone, it's quite a stable utility type business. So, you know, maybe that's acceptable. And a lot of their income is RPI linked these days as well. But then, you know, the operational metrics, again, at the bottom, pretty poor in the case of Vodafone, but pretty good in the case of Unilever, although obviously not guaranteed that will always be the case going forward. But if we just look at a bit of history on the next slide, on the right-hand side there, you can see Unilever has made pretty consistent return on capital. That's the green bars across the piece and with the axis on the right-hand side. And then its margins, they've done a great job actually of, you know, ramping their margins up over the years with a few blips along the way. But, you know, again, you might sort of worry a little bit, well, have they sort of gone as far as they can on that, or might that come down? In the case of Vodafone, was a great business pre-99, but then they went a bit nuts and bought management and then had to invest in the next generation sort of stuff. So, you know, the returns then were not that great going forward, and especially after they then sold Verizon off in the US down the line. Next slide. The winner could be Unilever on the way I look at things. And certainly it's provided better returns over time. But, you pay your money and take your choice in this game. So let's crack on from there now to the next stage. So how has it been for me since 2009? The top graph on the right-hand side there is just how my ISA has done over that period. So it's about 10% per annum. It was 14% at the end of 2019, but obviously the recent sell-off has hurt that a bit. It's better than the market, so I'm happy with that. My overall income has gone up by about 4-5% per annum. The RPI over that period has compounded at about 3%, so quite happy that I've managed to achieve my objective so far of growing my capital income in real terms. Who knows what the future holds? Compound income scores, that's a portfolio that I launched 5 years ago when I developed the scores, just to really see how efficient they were at picking stocks. And I've been running this portfolio based on a top quartile of compound income score since then. And that's done okay in the last 5 years, quite a bit better than the market. And actually, when I checked in a blog recently, actually outperformed about 98% of similar UK funds. So it seems to work. Quite pleased with that. But, you know, that's, again, history, really. And we've got to go forward from here. So thinking of that on the next slide, what is the outlook for dividends post the corona crash? Well, I wrote recently that I'm expecting a 30 to 50% reduction potentially in payouts this year. And we've already seen a lot of those coming through in suspensions, and we don't know quite how quickly some of those are going to come back. That's really based on long-term history and also futures markets for the US and Europe, which are sort of indicating cuts in that sort of region. And also Link Asset Services, who do the dividend monitor, they've also recently put out an update, and they're suggesting we could see about a 1/3 fall in UK equity dividends. That's if the oil majors manage to maintain their dividends, which Royal Dutch Shell seem to be showing some appetite for doing that. But if they don't, then they were saying it could be sort of up to a halving or slightly worse, about 50% off of UK dividends in the current year. So, somewhere in that sort of range is probably what you should be expecting for the market as a whole. Obviously, your own individual situations will differ. For myself, I was saying I'm hoping that my experience will be slightly better than that. So yeah, probably guessing maybe somewhere 20 to 30% down at worst, hopefully. But as yet, I haven't actually seen too many reductions coming through, a few suspensions here and there. But again, time will tell on that. We should see a bounce back thereafter. And once things get back to some sort of normality, But, you know, I fear it might take a bit longer than 2010, given all the bailouts and a bigger recession that people are expecting now, and also the fact that corporates might want to rebuild their balance sheets and maybe run with more conservative balance sheets, perhaps, who knows. But also I note in the US, companies that are getting help are going to be precluded from paying dividends and making share buybacks, which doesn't seem unreasonable, I suppose. And also I saw a news story yesterday saying sources were reporting the EU are considering something similar. I'm not aware, you know, if that's been explicitly stated in the UK or if they're going to do that. But, you know, I guess it must be a risk and, you know, probably not unreasonable if the state's bailing people out. We certainly saw that with the banks in 2009, that they didn't pay dividends for quite a few years after that. So, you know, I guess that's a risk as to why things may not bounce back that rapidly. So on the next slide, we're just taking a look at that. So could be a longer road back this time, I'm saying, really. So if you look at the top graph there, now that's just somebody's, you know, hypothetical example of how the economic recovery could play out. I suspect it could be sort of some kind of tick shape like they're showing there, but could morph into a W if, say, a vaccine's not forthcoming and more outbreaks are seen along the way. Plus, also, in terms of the economy, I'm not sure that things will necessarily bounce straight back to where they were. I think people would be more cautious. There might still be some distancing measures in place when things restart. It's anyone's guess, quite frankly, as to what goes on. But I'd probably be less optimistic about a V-shaped recovery than some people might be, and certainly as the stock market seems to be. The bottom chart, I'm not sure how easily you can see that, but basically that's some futures projections in the US market as to how they see dividends recovering over there. And you can basically, if you can't actually make out the numbers, but it's essentially suggesting that it's going to take quite a few years to get back to where we were at the end of last year, as opposed to 2009-10, when it only took probably a year or two to get back up to the same levels and beyond. So again, you know, some difficulties there in terms of the bounce back might take longer this time around, I suspect. Well, that's the economic and sort of dividend background. What about the stock market from here? So let's get on to that. We had the vote at the beginning and people seem to be a little bit cautious. This is your typical sort of market cycle of greed and fear. Now, in terms of, you know, people get euphoric at the top and then a bit of anxiety, and then you get some fear and denial as you come down. I think we were sort of probably been in that phase, but obviously we've had this big rally, which has made up about 50% of the falls that we saw. So, you know, maybe people are in denial on that basis. I don't know, but, you know, we'll have to see how that works out. So let's go and see what that looks like in terms of real world evidence. In terms of the S&P here, we've had this what I term as a sort of dead cat bounce, or is it off to the races again? You know, people seem to be being pretty bullish, and there's a few bulls out there in terms of the survey. So it bounced off of kind of the median PE level. It's rallied back up, as I say, recovered about 50% of the falls that it saw from the top, probably getting in towards that sort of band of resistance there, you know, shown in orange at the top of the chart. I think we've just seen it sort of coming off in the last day or two. Some commentators I follow quite closely, they're talking about, you know, better value being around about the sort of 2000 level on the S&P, and if things overshoot, you could see that going down to maybe the 1700, 1800 level, at which point it would probably be a good buying opportunity for longer term returns, because as ever, you know, the returns that you get are dictated by the price that you pay at the outset. So obviously, we'll have to see how the market goes from there. Well, what about the you know, longer term picture on that? Again, probably feels like it's too soon to call the bottom on the US market, just looking at this history here of bull markets and bear markets going back to the 1960s. I mean, there's only really the 1987 crash, which turned around in fairly short order of about 3 months. So unless this is going to sort of replicate that, you'd probably normally expect, you know, the bear market to drag on for a little bit longer than this, and particularly in terms of bear markets associated with recessions. We've generally seen worse drawdowns in that scenario. Certainly the last two, we saw drawdowns of close to 50%. And given that the IMF and others are saying this looks like being worse than 2009 and maybe even as bad as the 1929 depression, that would tend to suggest, based on history, that there could well be some more downside to come. Looking at the UK market on the next slide. Again, just reiterating the point here, recessions tend to lead to worse drawdowns. FTSE chart, you can see the last two times, again, we had those sort of 50% downdrafts. Again, we did about 30 at the worst, and we've had a bit of a rally since then. So again, suggesting there could be more downside. Having said that, you know, valuations are getting relatively low. On the left-hand side, you've got the P of the all-share index, I say approaching bear market lows back in sort of 2009-10. It did get sub 10 times, which is sort of a fairly classic level to think about bottoming out in a bear market. And obviously, you'd probably expect the P to start spiking upwards fairly soon as we see all the downgrades coming through. On the right-hand side, you've got the FTSE dividend yield. Obviously, that spiked up massively because people are expecting and we're seeing all these dividend cuts. But it's interesting just to eyeball that and notice that since sort of about 2010, that's largely ranged in sort of 3.5% to 4.5% range as to where the market has wanted to find support or resistance, if you like. Okay, so that's the valuation. So the next slide is just some technical stuff. Now, sorry, the first one is a bit of a mess on the left-hand side. So it's something I got off of Twitter, actually. But it's got some long-term trends drawn on there, which, you know, I'm not a technical analyst myself, but I think, you know, there's something to these. Sometimes you get economies growing at a certain rate, so the market can probably sustain a certain rate of rise. And quite interesting, there's quite a collection of, red support lines running up there at the bottom, in between about 4,500 and 5,000. So, you know, we bounced off about 5,000, which is the top one of those. So, maybe that will provide support again if we do see another sell-off, or perhaps it might extend a little bit further. I don't know, time will tell. On the right-hand side is a slightly less messy chart. That's, again, showing the longer-term trend in FTSE. It sort of found some support in that sort of mid-range level around about 5,000, as we know. But slightly alarmingly, obviously, the last two downturns went below 4,000 to about 3,700. Seems to have some sort of magnetic attraction to that level. So one hopes we're not returning there again. But again, you know, given the economic outlook, I guess you couldn't rule it out. So that sort of technical and economic background. But what about sort of valuation measured yield, which is close to my heart? On the next slide, let's take a look at that. This is a FTSE 100 ready reckoner that I've done. So basically, I've assumed the dividend base from the end of January, based on where the FTSE was at the top there, as you can see in the first row of the table. And the yield then was 4.5%. Then if you rebase that dividend or those dividends to either say 67% of where they were, so that's the one-third cut, which is perhaps, you know, the best case scenario coming out of this, and then the worst case, say a 50% reduction. And then I've imputed, you know, what levels would the FTSE be trading at if you use that sort of 3.5% to 4.5% range that reproduced on the right-hand side there again. So at the most optimistic, you could get back up to 6,300 maybe. And obviously we were, you know, heading towards that sort of, well, last couple of weeks, but not quite that far. Middle of the range at 4%. Well, you get some support coming in around about 5,000. Interestingly, that with a one-third reduction in dividends and a 4.5% yield, you know, 4,957, that's not far off where we bounced from. So, you know, maybe a retest of the low, and then perhaps, or maybe even a slightly higher low might be possible if the dividends shape up in that fashion. However, if things cut up really rough and, you know, the oil majors end up cutting the dividends and the economy is a lot worse than people expect, doesn't bounce back as quickly, and we do end up with a 50% reduction, then, you know, worst case there is spookily again 3,699. It's that 3,700 figure again. So we'll watch out. You know, maybe we might get back down there again. I hope not, obviously, but time will tell, I suppose. So let's just move on from there. So how am I dealing with that and surviving it? Personally, like a lot of other people, I think I underestimated it coming into this, maybe a bit complacent. I did take some action early on to sell some more vulnerable transport-related stocks, but I did come into it reasonably well-placed with some cash positions and physical gold, so that sort of helped a little bit at the margin. I'm not panicking about the dividend cuts and suspensions given my cash holdings, and I'd hope and expect that, as I said already, my portfolio may not be as badly affected, but, you know, say maybe 20-30% reduction in income and possibly even capital values going forward from here, or possibly even worse if we get back down to that 3,700 level. However, it is a market of stocks, and I'm focusing on stocks and opportunities thrown up by the volatility, and therefore perhaps trading a little bit more actively than I would do normally, but I'm certainly not in a rush to reinvest too much cash just yet, given that sort of history and, you know, where the market is in its sort of greed and fear cycle, if you like. Okay, so what does the future hold, and where I? Well, you know, the fix is in again, as it were. The Fed have been ramping up their support and trying to rig the market again, as far as I can tell, and they seem to be prepared to do whatever it takes, as sort of Draghi said a few years back in the last Euro crisis. I mean, they've even sort of gone out and bought or buying ETFs in high yield bonds, which is quite amazing. I mean, who knows if the next downdraft, perhaps they'll start buying equities. I don't know, but remains to be seen if they've done enough in the face of you know, a large and hopefully short-lived recession. But the only sort of thing beyond that, people haven't really started to think about the sort of the fiscal side of things. Obviously, there might be some fiscal spending take place. They might try and, you know, boost the economies by doing more infrastructure spending, but it's not like a post-war situation. I know people have likened it to that, but it's not like a lot of stuff has been destroyed that needs rebuilding, but they might try and do something similar, but infrastructure spending on stuff that needs upgrading. But it, you know, it's quite depressing in terms of we've spent about 10 or 11 years trying to get out of you know, financial hole that we're in, and now this has all taken us back to just about the same situation in terms of budget deficits and debt to GDP. So you know, I think there might be some tax rises ahead again to try and sort of deal with that. But, you know, maybe they'll fight shy of doing austerity as aggressively as they did before. Don't know. You know, the magic money tree seems to have been discovered. So, you know, maybe they'll just keep on printing money. And the effect of that, obviously, it's quite a deflationary scenario that we're going through. But, you know, you'd think that with all the money printing going on, that at some point that may well lead through to inflation. You know, I know that people probably thought that back in 2009. It didn't happen, so, you know, who knows? Maybe it won't happen again this time. But you know, I think that's got to be the risk. And on that basis, I think, you know, in the absence of them failing and it turning into a sort of debt depression, deflation type scenario, that you know, equities are probably the place to try and protect you against, you know, return of inflation, and other real assets are available, of course. But, you know, can't really see that bonds yielding 0.5% or whatever it is, and, you know, cash yielding nothing, is going to protect you much from inflation picking up, as it may well do. And even in the last 10 years, it's still gone up 3% a year, despite, you know, people worrying about deflation and generally perceiving, oh, it's not been that bad. So summary and concluding thoughts. Compounding has worked for me so far, but the future, of course, may be more challenging. And there may be fewer suitable candidates after all this. As I mentioned, obviously, some dividends may not come back as quickly as they did last time. On the plus side, those that do or are able to pay decent dividends and grow their dividends, provided they might get a re-rating. So that's something perhaps to bear in mind. Obviously, inflation, which I touched on there, which, you know, I don't actually think will come roaring through straight away. But if it does come back ultimately, then obviously that can impact upon equity ratings if it gets out of hand or gets too high. So it's not a one-way street for equities and inflation, but they do sort of help you to protect against it. But obviously valuations are pretty low in the UK at the moment anyway. So you know, that's something to worry about another day, I think. Very bad economic hit from this. Markets currently seem to be assuming a V-shaped recovery on the back of you know, all that the Fed's doing and their sort of whatever it takes stance. But I'm not so sure, you know, that it's going to be that easy. But, you know, I'll be looking for opportunities if we do see another sell-off. Of course, I might be wrong. It could be, you know, we go racing away again off to the races. You know, I'm not too worried if I am, because I've still got plenty of exposure. So there we go. That's really, that's where, you know, where I am, how I see things, rightly or wrongly. Obviously, nobody really knows, to be honest, but quite happy to take any questions now, if there are any.
Jamie, thank you very much indeed. This is from Phil McFadden. Do you use specific Stockopedia screens?
I do use Stockopedia, and I've used some of their screens. I think there's a few of the income ones that a couple of them come out better than some of the others. I mean, the problem I find with screening is that, which is sort of why I devised my own sort of compound income scoring system, that sometimes they throw up quite a limited list of stocks. If you look at some of their guru screens as well, that they have quite a sort of funny mix of stocks in them, even though it might be quite a sensible strategy that's not always doesn't give you necessarily the sort of stocks you'd expect. And you know, you're probably missing a lot of stuff there. So you can put all your criteria, and the more criteria you put in, the fewer and fewer stocks you end up sort of coming out the end of it. So you can potentially miss quite a lot of things there. So obviously you can look at their ranks, you know, across the piece, and you know, that's something that I do as well, because if you look at the history of how their ranks have performed, then you know, you probably want to be focusing on the top sort of two quintiles, you know, scoring 60 and above, or maybe even 50 and above. But as I said in my presentation on the way through, that the biggest thing to try and do in this game is to avoid the losers. And again, if you look at the Stockopedia ranks, and you know, probably similar with my own scores, you want to be avoiding the bottom two quintiles, really, because that's, you know, where the danger lies and where you can sort of get your value traps and the serial disappointers. But not to say you can't buy stocks with those sort of scores or from that part of the scores, if you like, that can do well. Obviously, there are always stocks that do better or worse than expected. But, you know, that's my take on it. Anyway, so I do a bit of screening on there to answer the question. I say that I think it's the best dividends and... I think there's another one I can't recall off the top of my head. I think in my recent blog, I did look at that and how they compared to how this compound income scores portfolio has done. And, there were a couple that came close to it, which probably seem okay. But as I say, when you actually look at them, they sometimes have a bit of a funny list of names.
So John Dunn asks, do you invest in small cap stocks for dividend yield, or do you just restrict yourself to the FTSE 350 or thereabouts?
Right. No, I do invest across the piece. So that universe of income paying stocks that I screen for, there's 578 in there at the moment. So that goes right through from FTSE down to AIM stocks, includes small cap as well. So I look across the piece and I will invest in all of those. But I mean, that's another reason for being very diversified or more diversified. So I don't run into liquidity problems. So I can still access small caps that way. But if I was running a really focused portfolio for the whole of what I'm investing, yeah, I probably wouldn't be able to go down that far in the in the market cap scale.
So Nyla Shukla asks, are you likely in the environment in the short run to move away from a dividend-based investing to value and quality and take income by selling?
No, I mean, I wouldn't be selling. I mean, I don't sort of look to take income by selling. So no, short answer would be no, but... obviously, yes, income will be harder to come by or harder to find. But you know, I think, as I said, I think those companies that can still pay their dividends will probably be quite sought after.
A follow-up question from Freddie Ahad. Would you ever consider a dividend non-payer if you see it has the potential to pay a dividend soon?
Yeah, I wouldn't rule it out. But I mean, it wouldn't get picked up in my process as it stands, because I specifically exclude zero payers from the stocks I'm screening for. Obviously, I might come across a stock that is in the market when I'm doing other research, or like stock screens elsewhere, and might find something. If I was really taken by it, then yes, I could buy those, but I don't tend to, as I say, because quite a lot of them tend to be sort of blue sky hope stocks, you know, not earning much money. But obviously, if it's profitable and got decent sort of metrics in terms of its return on capital and operating margins and things like that, then, yeah, I could consider it.
And Andrew Talbot asks, what are your views on REITs, real estate investment trusts?
Well, you need to be a little bit careful. Obviously, the discounts have sort of widened out massively on those, but, you know, the market is a discounting mechanism. And obviously, it's, as we're already seeing, a few announcements have come through where companies are seeing not all of their rent being collected. So you've seen some saying, well, we've this quarter end payment date, we've received 76% or 80% of our expected income. So that's the first thing to watch out for. And, you know, obviously that might bounce back if the economy comes straight back in a V-shaped fashion. But equally, if lots of businesses go bust or find that they're challenged, then, you know, that rent could remain under pressure. And then the other thing to be aware of or wary of with REITs is the gearing. You need to look at the loan to value and covenants and all that sort of stuff, because, you know, if those rents fall away too far too quickly, and the valuations get sort of created perhaps by the valuers once the fog clears, because at the moment they're all putting warnings on their valuations. So you know, yeah, long term they're not a bad place to be, but just need to tread a bit carefully at the moment, I'd say.
Ankit Hadini asks, when it comes to the UK market, how do you see it behaving when there's Brexit at the end of the year with this whole coronavirus situation?
Well, obviously, Brexit is that ongoing unknown uncertainty. But, you know, to a degree, I suppose we've had almost a sort of early run of that in a way. We've had all these problems with supply chains and food supplies and fruit and veg not being picked in the fields because they can't get the workers. So is Brexit going to make that worse? I mean, I suppose it might do, but, you know, it's just another thing we've got to get through, really. Again, perhaps another reason for being, you know, a bit more cautious about, oh, it's fine, everything will be back to normal in 3 weeks when we're all let out again. You know, I'm not so sure. Yeah, we might still be dealing with, you know, social distancing measures, only sort of half the people can go to the restaurants or whatever. And will people be so keen to go and book holidays and that if they're not sure if there's going to be another outbreak? You know, I think until there's a vaccine, you know, discovered and tested and then widely available, you know, the risk is that we might see further outbreaks or things like that on top of, you know, Brexit issues along the way. So, yeah, I'm not pretending that it's a great outlook. And yeah, that's why I'm probably still on the more cautious side of things and not getting carried away with the rally that we've seen.
And Janie Anker Luffert asks, would it be a good idea to start investing in the global bond index?
I wouldn't say so myself. I say I'm an equity man, so I'm probably not the best person to ask. But, you know, you just look at sort of bond yields and where they've come from and where they've got to, unless you're thinking that we're going to have a deflationary depression, in which case, you know, fixed income and cash would become more valuable as general prices fell and fell and fell. That's probably the only scenario under which I would buy bonds myself. But, you know, that's not something that I don't think the governments and central banks seem to be doing their utmost to try and avoid that situation. But of course, they might fail. But so, yeah, that's the only scenario under which I would buy a global bond fund. I mean, might be a source of, you know, safety in the short term. It could be a tactical trade, but say it's not something I'd want to hold for the long term.
And Ben Sharman says, thanks for the presentation. When you're looking at investment trusts for income, is there anything else you consider other than reserves and number of years of dividend increases? He goes on to say CTY looks good with a 6% plus yield and over 50 years of increases.
Absolutely. Well, the things he mentions there are certainly things that I look at, but the other factors to bear in mind or take into account that you need to be comfortable with, obviously, gearing is another feature, or, you know, the ability to borrow. So that can enhance and also detract from returns for investment trusts. So that's something also to look at and be aware of. And then also the charges that they levy and, you know, how high or low those are. Obviously, that is seen as historically one of the advantages of investment trusts, that they tend to be lower charging than open-ended companies, although that gap has narrowed somewhat as there's been more fee pressure on the open-ended companies in recent years. So, yeah, those would be the main things that you need to sort of satisfy yourself about. Yes, obviously the gearing, obviously, and then obviously the strategy, what the fund is actually investing in, and are you comfortable with the asset class and the makeup of the portfolio?
And Neil Shaw asks, are share buybacks the same as dividends in your opinion?
They're not the same. I mean, it's all choice of use of capital for a company. Now, obviously, share buybacks, you know, some people argue that they're a good thing and you should take them into account. There are theories that you should look at shareholder total return, so you factor in dividends and share buybacks, and that has been suggested as an even better way maybe of identifying stocks. I mean, historically the difference between share buybacks and dividends was that companies were always very reluctant to cut their dividends and seemed to only do it as a last resort. And although obviously this time around, it's been much quicker and faster that people, because it's such an extreme situation that they've been forced to sort of withdraw dividends or suspend them at least. And some have just had to, you know, stop paying them because they're not going to have the wherewithal to do so. Share buybacks were never quite, you know, as robust as that. You know, it was something that companies would probably do quite regularly, but then as soon as things cut up rough, they'd stop doing it. And, you know, that wasn't seen as a bad thing necessarily, was they were always fought shy of cutting dividends if they possibly could. Although, as I say, this time around, you know, they've been a lot quicker to cut, and the downside seems to be a lot greater than you would have seen historically. That's what I'd say on that, really.
And just a couple more questions. John Tan says, the market seems overvalued relative to the outlook. Do you think the market's irrational? And if so, why?
Well, certainly in the US, I think you could argue that the valuations were quite high over there, and probably still looking relatively full. I think when we looked at the valuations of the UK market on the way through, I wouldn't describe them as high. If anything, you know, they're getting down towards, you know, good value territory with the PE approaching sort of 10 times or less. Obviously, that will spike up as the downgrades come through. So, yeah, I wouldn't say the UK. And also, you know, investors have been quick to observe, well, UK is a rubbish market because look how it's underperformed the US for the last 20 years or whatever. Although the dividends, once you factor those in, it's not as bad as all that. But, you know, we've essentially gone nowhere in capital terms for 20 years. And that goes back to more the valuation at the start of that period in 1999. I would say valuations were irrational back then because, you know, remember very well the dot-com bubble. And, you know, I was running income portfolios at the time and it was just nuts. You know, what people buying stuff hand over fist that had no revenues, no earnings, nothing. And the, you know, the real world economy stocks, you know, just on bargain valuations. You know, but that was irrational, I would say. But today, you know, the valuations, P and dividend yields are pretty recognizable. And, you know, there's no sort of similar dot-com thing going on, certainly not in the UK. Obviously, US and other places have got all their sort of nifty five or six, whatever the latest acronym is for them, you know, the Googles and Apples of this world. But, you know, they're... So, you know, there could be an extent to which, you know, the US markets, some of those stocks, I don't know, I'm not big on the US market or tech stocks particularly, but, you know, equally they seem to have come out pretty well from this whole crisis. So it might just be that trend carries on and they continue sort of mopping up. Certainly Amazon has been a big winner out of it, and Netflix is, you know, booming because everyone's sitting at home watching box sets or whatever. But, you know, I'm probably not the person to pass judgment on those tech stocks. But as far as the UK goes, my area, you know, I wouldn't say valuations are irrational. If anything, verging on being good value.
Thank you very much, Jamie. I think we better leave it there. But before you leave, can you tell listeners where they can find you?
Well, I put a website up a few years back when I sort of started this to sort of detail my process. That's called compoundincome.org. I mean, if you just stick compound income into a search engine, it'll come up, I'm sure. And I'm on Twitter under the handle Jamie at Compound Income if people want to follow me there. I do mostly stuff just about sort of investing and related to that. So if you're interested in cats doing funny things or something, then yeah, not the person to follow. But if you find out about investing stuff, then you can find me there as well.
Great. Well, we'll put a link to your website and your slides underneath the recording of this webinar. So for everyone listening, if you want an email notification of events or webinars we're organising, please do the sign up for events on the right hand side of the homepage at PI World. I think there's two boxes, one to subscribe and one to sign up for events. So sign up there and we don't spam anyone. And lastly, please do tell your investing friends about PI World and write comments or like our videos on Twitter and bulletin boards and YouTube. We'd like to go on providing these free webinars and getting good speakers, and they rely on getting good audience numbers. So thanks very much for joining us and stay well.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.